Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am Pat Rulo, and today I'm just so thrilled to share a recent Firebird Book Award winning author with you. He is Nick Chiarkas, and his winning book is titled Weepers. Nick was the director of Wisconsin State Public Defender Agency for 22 years. He served as the deputy chief counsel and research director to the President's Commission on Organized Crime, professor of law, professor of criminology, a New York police officer, and a U.S. Army paratrooper. He received doctorate and master's degrees from Columbia University, a law degree from Temple University, a master's and bachelor's degree from John Jay College, and was a Pickett Fellow at Harvard University. He is the author of the award-winning novel Weepers, and the sequel, Nunzio's Way, will be out in late June 2022. He has also received awards for his poetry. He grew up in the Al Smith Projects on Manhattan's Lower East Side, where Weepers takes place. And when he was in the fourth grade, his mother was told by the principal, Nick was unlikely ever to complete high school, so you must steer him toward a simple and secure vocation. So much more to know, but let's get going. Welcome to the network, Nick.
Thank you. I wish my mother was alive to hear that introduction. She would have believed it. My father might have been doubtful, but she would have believed it.
You know what I say? I say ha ha to the principal who uttered those words. You know, I just can't imagine how many teachers may even continue to speak like this to parents and children, and how these families self-fulfill that prediction.
Yeah. Can I tell you something that'll take about 2 minutes?
Absolutely. I have all day for you.
I was actually, I don't think many people know this except my wife. I was actually sitting outside the principal's office. It was after school, and I could hear him talking to my mother in the room that the secretary was gone. And a teacher, a lovely woman, came over to me, and at the time I didn't realize it, but obviously she knew that I could hear what was going on. Mm-hmm. And she took me into she had a bag of groceries. She was on her way home. And she took me into the teacher's lounge, which was empty again. School was done. And she took out a pound cake from the bag that she purchased. I don't know what it might have been by Drake, but I don't remember. It was just the white pound cake with a vanilla frosting, and asked me if I liked pound cake. And I said, yeah, especially the frosting. Well, this lovely teacher made two cups of tea, gave me a cup. I'm a fourth grader. I felt like a big shot now.
Oh.
And she cut the cake horizontally. So there was about an inch of cake and the rest was frosting. And she cut that part in half and gave me half. And she said very nice things to me about believing in me. But then she said to read everything I can find and to always eat the icing off the cake. When I got my doctorate from Columbia, I tracked her family down and mailed it to her with a note that said, look what you did.
Oh.
You know, and I tell you that story because so many people like you, Pat, my dear, dear friend, who are doing lovely things for other people and at times may not know that they appreciate it or that they recognize it, mm-hmm. but they do. I'm sure all her life, she might not have even remembered that incident, mm-hmm. but there's so many teachers out there that are touching students every single day and making a difference in their life, and they don't know it. I tell you that to tell them it's happening. Mm-hmm. They know it. Mm-hmm. You did it. You changed stuff.
Oh,
anyway.
That's a beautiful story. I have chills hearing that. Thank goodness for that woman. She was just, that was like an angel that just came down the hallway. She knew just what to do at the right time. Just think of how life-changing that was. I love it. I love how she cut the cake. That's just brilliant.
Yeah. I still do that. I still do. I'll tell you another crazy, crazy thing about me. It's just a nuts thing. I'm filled with insecurities and guilt and lots of stuff. And every now and then when I'm feeling really bad about something from my child or whatever it is, I sit down at a table and have a cup of tea and a cookie or something and pretend I'm talking to my 10-year-old self. Oh. And trying to get all of the information out of whatever that guilt feeling is that I can learn something from, and then kindly ask it to leave. But I always go back to that cup of tea. A piece of cake at a table. Anyway, sorry.
Do not be sorry. This is the highlight of the conversation. This is just just beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. That's so honest and open, and I'm glad you shared me. Thank you so much. And well, you know what? That makes me even more happy. Not only congratulations on the book win, but you were the grand prize winner of all of, you know, we had 672 people that entered. So bravo and congratulations.
I giggled. I'm an old guy. I giggled. It was wonderful. I sent it to my kids. I said, showed it to my wife.
I love
you. It was just absolutely wonderful. Well, thank you.
Good. I'm so happy. I didn't even know your backstory. This is just all plays in well. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy. Thank you for this bit of conversation. All right, my friend. Let's go back if we can. We'll talk about your book. But before we do that, I know when I first got your book and I saw something about the Al Smith projects, I didn't know what that was. Maybe give us a brief glimpse into growing up. Maybe just give us a brief glimpse as to your past, so it will take us to the present as to how you wrote your book.
Sure. So originally we lived in a tenement. And the tenements in New York, this is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, in the Two Bridges neighborhood, which is a very, at that time, and probably still is, very dangerous place. The Two Bridges neighborhood is the area between the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge. The South Street docks borders it, the Bowery borders it. And the tenements, there's my mother, my father, and three kids, my brother and sister and myself, in a two-room apartment. One was the bedroom, which was the three kids. My mother and father slept in the other room, which had the kitchen. The bathroom was in the hallway that you shared, or the toilet was in the hallway that you shared with the floor. And it was always scary for a little kid to have to leave the apartment to go to the bathroom. So it was a step up to move into the projects, even though it was also a very dangerous place. But the bathrooms were inside the apartment. There were three bedrooms. My brother and I shared one, and it was safer than the tenement with the fire escape outside. The gangs ruled the projects. On the other hand, there was something, and I don't want to say terribly positive, but there was something unique. I'm going to say positive about growing up there. I remember people talking about the Lower East Side as kind of a melting pot where all of these different ethnic backgrounds come together. Well, it wasn't a melting pot, and it's probably a bad way to think of it. It's more like a fruit salad, you know? Nothing melts, but everything is kind of unique and tastes good all combined. Mm-hmm. For example, and please stop me if I'm going on and on, okay?
Sure.
That's a deal you and I should have.
Okay.
You should say, okay, time to move on. Let's go to something else. So I'm going to do this quick. It's 1955. I'm probably 10 or 11 years old. I'm sitting on a bench in the projects, and you sat on the bench, like the back of the bench, and your feet on the seat of the bench in TF canvas shoes, because that was cool to sit on the back of the bench. And I'm reading a comic book, Little Lulu. I don't know if that's still around, but I like Little Lulu. And a big kid, Sylvester Riley. His race doesn't matter. He's a black kid. except that it kind of does for this story. And he was a tough kid. He was like the toughest kid that I knew in the projects. He was 16, 15, and he was in my class, and I was 10. And he came over and he said, "Mickey, what are you holding? Let me hold your comic book." And I said, "No," because I had to act tough. And he took my comic book and pushed me over the back of the bench into these brittle bushes and left with my comic book. And I got up and dusted myself off and looked around. Nobody saw it, so that was cool. And I waited a little while, and then I went upstairs to my apartment in 20 Catherine Slip, the project's apartment 5E. And my lovely Italian mother met me at the door and said, she always began a statement or a question with, but Nicky, where's your comic book? And I said, Ma, you know, I think, and she said, Stavagicciadru, which in Italian kind of means shut your mouth, cucumber. I don't know why she called me that. She said, "I saw Sylvester Riley take your comic book." So she grabbed me by the hand, and we walked over to 10 Catherine Slip where he lived. Oh. This was not good news for little Nicky. Oh. And my mother knocked on the door, and Sylvester's mother came to the door. And my mother said to her, "Mrs. Riley, your son took my son's comic book. And if you were looking at me right now, you would see all of my hand gestures." And Mrs. Riley said, "Sylvester, who happened to be home, I was praying to God that he wasn't home. He came," and she said, "give Nicky back his comic book." Now, one thing I liked about that, I digress, was she didn't ask him if he took my comic book. She didn't want to give him the opportunity to lie, right? He went back to the back room, got the little Lulu comic book, came out, handed it to me, and gave me a look that said, "Tomorrow's not a good day for you, Nicky." And I gave him a look like I didn't know my mother saw. Anyway, my mother thanked Mrs. Riley, and Mrs. Riley thanked my mother, and we left. So it was race neutral, and yet that's why I don't like it melted. Each mother appreciated the other. Each kid, me and Sylvester, kind of had a relationship. My mother didn't call the police. If she showed up with the police, I think Sylvester Riley's mother would have protected Sylvester, said, "Go away." The mothers, the two mothers, handled the problem. We kind of stopped doing that at some point, where the neighborhood and the families and the mothers kind of took care of stuff. And that was the impetus for Weepers. That's what I wanted to tell in Weepers, how the family rallied. There's very little in Weepers about anybody calling the police. There's a police detective in it and stuff like that. But the parents, the mothers, the kids, they kind of worked everything out. And that's how the projects felt. You walk through them. Sometimes you would get into a fight. Sometimes you wouldn't. But it was life in the projects. And as bad as that was, and then I'm going to shut up after I tell you this. As bad as that was, when I finished basic training, I'm just a kid from New York, and advanced infantry training. My best friend was a guy named Elwood Bayless who went through the training with me, and he lived in Newark, New Jersey, and we flew down to Fort Benning, Georgia to take paratrooper school, jump school. And we stopped in Columbus, Georgia, and we figured we'll get something to eat. This is 1963. We'll get something to eat and maybe a drink. It was a Sunday, Saturday. And then we'll go to Fort Benning and report in for jump training on Monday. And we walked into a diner, and we didn't see the sign that said whites only. And they wouldn't, they were going to throw us out. We were in full uniform, We were just told how proud our country was of us, that we were soldiers and we were getting ready to go off to Vietnam and fight for our country. They're going to throw us out. We wouldn't leave. The sheriff picked us up. We were in the back of his car, and he said, I could either take you to jail or I'll drive you to Fort Benning right now. And we went to Fort Benning. Wow. Growing up in the projects, I had no idea that a white kid and a black kid could not sit down at a lunch counter on the Lower East Side of Manhattan and have a hamburger together, or that existed any place in the world. Now, I was naive. I didn't read the papers every day. I didn't know what was going on elsewhere. But I was this proud, elated soldier with my best friend. And that was, but for what the principal said, that was one of the most crushing blows that I felt.
Wow.
Anyway, so growing up in the projects wasn't as bad as living in Columbus, Georgia then. As far as I'm concerned.
I get that. Absolutely get that. Yeah.
Growing up in the projects wasn't safe, and you knew rich people and middle-class people had an advantage, but you also learned how to survive in the project. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's my long-winded way of saying that there were some things about the projects that, looking back, I appreciate.
Mm-hmm. No, I get that. Thank you for sharing that. You're very descriptive and colorful, and you know, you kind of feel what you might have felt too. And that's what I enjoyed about your book. So maybe just give us a peek into the storyline of the book so we can entice our readers now that they've got some background on you.
So if I had to come up like with an elevator pitch for it, the story is that a New York City police officer is killed in 1957 in the Al Smith projects. In 1951, in those same projects, Angelo was walking home with his father on Christmas Eve, and his father vanished. That is, Angelo was walking in front of him. His father was pulling a little two-wheel push cart filled with Christmas presents. It was snowing, and Angelo was dancing and trying to catch snowflakes. And he turned around, and the cart was standing there, and his father was gone. Those two events are related, 1951 and 1957. And they bring together... In 1957, Angelo is on his way out of the projects at 2 o'clock in the morning to set fire to the grocery store he works in. And on his way there, he's the witness of a cop being killed by two gang leaders, an undercover cop being killed by two gang leaders. And they see Angelo. And the events that unfold in Weepers bring together a priest, the mafia boss, a detective, and Angelo, who is a gang leader of the Weepers. Mm-hmm. And the secret to the Weepers gang, and I'll give it away, is the name of it was originally the Reapers, the Grim Reapers. Mm-hmm. But Angelo got into a fight with another gang member. And during the fight, Angelo cries. My wife says, and she's right, Angelo is, this is an autobiography, mm-hmm. fictionalized. Uh-huh. And Angelo cries during the fight, and the gang makes fun of him and saying he's the Weepers, not the Reapers. Mm-hmm. And he goes home and he tells his uncle what happened and that he cried and he doesn't think he can go to school anymore. And his uncle tells him to take off his shirt, and with a pen, the uncle writes Weepers on Angelo's shoulder with a teardrop coming out of it. And he said, that's now the name of your gang. Own it. Oh. Tell them that's the name. Mm-hmm. And so they become the Weepers. And that's kind of the story.
Nick, why is this not a movie?
How come? Yeah. Why?
What's wrong with these people?
Oh my God. One of the reviews on Amazon is a lovely review. Don't believe 2 stars. One of the nice reviews is that this sounds like a cross between A Bronx Tale and The Wire. How come it's not a movie yet?
Exactly. That's how it's written. When you read it, when you're done, you feel like you watched it.
Oh, that's nice. I love that.
Mm-hmm. That's how I feel. Why did you decide to write this? How did this even come about?
So when I was a cop, as a kid, I worked in a grocery store and I would be chased, I would deliver groceries, and on the way back from the delivery, gang members would chase me, and I was very good about running across roofs and jumping from one roof to another, and many other kids wouldn't do that. And I could hide in the New York Public Library. I can get there from the roof. And I would hide in the fiction section, remembering my wonderful, beautiful teacher, and I would start reading fiction, and fell in love with poetry and fiction. It would take me, it would take me out of the neighborhood. It would take me on adventures. Right. When I was a cop, I thought it would be interesting to write short stories about conversations from a radio car that you hear in the back seat. And I've written a couple of poems about conversations in the back of a radio car, but never thought about writing a novel. And then when I retired from being the state public defender, I thought I would like to tell, there's a lot of stuff going on about poor people and whether they deserve or don't deserve. And I've always been amazed that we are not in awe of how much they have to carry, as opposed to being critical about what they need. And I wanted to tell the story of my neighborhood, but my doctorate is in sociology, specifically in social deviance, of course, because that interests me. But I didn't want to tell it like a, I believe the best way to tell the truth is through fiction. So I wanted to tell the truth, but I didn't want to write a sociology kind of paper. Right. I wanted to write a story about what it's like, and decided to see if I had any talent whatsoever to do that. And so I took a shot.
Wow. I love that. How did you know when your book was done?
I actually didn't. I finished it, and I thought it was done. And I gave it to my wife to read, and she didn't like the ending, and she ended it sooner, way sooner. And, you know, at the end, I kind of wrapped everything up, and it was a nice little package. And so she changed the ending. I still don't think it's done. If I could write it over again, I would have written it sequentially. So it begins in 1951, but then the priest tells a story about what happened in 1920, and then I think I would have started it in 1920, and then gone to 1948, and then 1951, and then 1957, and so I don't think it's ever done.
Right.
But I think at some point you have to
stop.
Release it. You have to send it to somebody.
Oh, so we know it's still not done. How's that?
It's not done. No, it's not done. And thus I had to write Nunzio's Way.
Exactly.
Wasn't quite done yet.
I love that. So how you're almost done with that one if you're coming out late June?
It is done. Mm-hmm. I am. And this annoys my public. I was very lucky to get both books, a traditional publishing contract with a modest advance. And my publisher is very annoyed that I am once again reading through it just to be sure I can let it go.
Right.
But I think I've promised her that by the end of the weekend, I will be finished with it.
Does she say, but Nikki, we got to get it done.
Just give it to me. I'll read it again and tell you if it needs anything.
But Nikki.
Nikki.
Oh, my gosh. All right, my friend, as we begin to wrap up, I want to make sure that we're not missing anything that you wanted to talk about today.
Nunzio's Way?
Yeah. Give us a little peek into that.
Was a lot of fun doing. Nunzio's Way, the elevator pitch would be that it's 1960, and in 1960, the Democratic Party was not supporting the current Democratic mayor. That's a fact. So Declan Arden, who's an ambitious New York City lawyer, asks Nunzio Sabino, who is the mafia boss of all times in New York City, to help him win the election. And Nunzio says, and it's the first line in the book, "Pal, in this city, you can have anything you want if you kill the right four people." Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in Italy, a beautiful woman, red-haired woman, Heather Potter, just killed a top Gomorrah, which is organized crime, boss, and is now on her way to New York City to kill Nunzio and Mac Pastamadeo, who is Angelo, his father. Angelo is the leader of the Weepers.
Right.
I loved being a cop. I thought it was a lot of fun. I'll give you one piece and I'll stop. In 1969, I was one of the few New York City police officers selected to provide security at Woodstock,
wow,
in upstate New York.
Oh.
And that was a wonderful experience.
Yes.
And when I was in an army hospital, I received a lovely, lovely letter, short letter, but a lovely letter from J.D. Salinger, which still hangs on my wall. And those, besides my two children that I raised as a single parent, those are the lovely, lovely, lucky things that happened to me. How's that for a wrap-up?
That's beautiful. You're beautiful. I just feel so...
No, you are. Look what you do. Look, we should talk about what you're doing. We should have more people. You should have more people should know what you're doing for these shelters, for these poor women and children in these shelters. I mean, that's what gives me goosebumps. That's the amazing thing that you're doing. That's the important stuff. That's the everyday important stuff. This is a story. That's the real life stuff, that touching people. Oh. So good to see you, my friend, my dear friend.
Oh, thank you. We should have our own fan club, you and me.
Yeah. I want to be the head of yours.
I'll be the head of yours, and we'll have a good time. All right, Nick, how about if you share any contact information where folks can learn more about you, find out more about your book and your upcoming book? Just lead us wherever you like.
NickCharkis.com is my website, and people should feel free to reach out to me. There's a way you can contact me from there. They can have my email, nick.charkis@gmail.com. I don't, because it's a traditional publication of the books, I don't sell them myself. But my Henschel House will sell them. Amazon sells them. Local bookstores, and I love local bookstores, will sell them. Oh, you'll appreciate this.
Okay.
One of the things I love most about Weepers is that my son, Josh, auditioned for reading the audiobook.
Yes.
And out of two dozen people, he was selected, and there's no pull to it because it's a traditional publication. So anytime I want to hear his beautiful voice reading my story, I can hear it.
I saw that on Amazon. I saw Josh Chiarkas, and I thought, oh, wonder what relation that is. That is beautiful. That is a gift for both of you.
That is. That is just, I just love that. And he does a great job. He does a great job. Oh. Gives me goosebumps.
Me too. I just got them. That's so, thank you. I don't even know how to thank you for today. I knew I was looking forward to it, but I didn't.
Me too.
I know. I didn't know how much I was going to enjoy it. Thank you so, so much for just being honest, open, and sharing you today, your book. Please share Nunzio's Way when it's ready to roll, because I want to have another opportunity to talk with you.
I will do that. And with your permission, I would like to advertise you on my website. I want to advertise what you do and what you're doing for the shelters.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Whatever information you need from me, just let me know. I appreciate that. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you, my friend.